Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane. The Marcellus Formation is a huge natural gas field stretching over five states, including Pennsylvania. And over the past decade, the gas drilling industry has been able to tap into some of the estimated trillions of cubic feet of natural gas trapped in Marcellus shale rock formations. Suffice it to say, the industry has brought both good times and, some say, misery to areas of rural Pennsylvania. During the boom, thousands of jobs flowed into small towns and local businesses thrived. But the industry took a downturn last year because of falling natural gas prices. Much of the work has dried up, and many local residents say they were left with a terrible legacy, well water contaminated by the fracking process used to access natural gas. So, how are these residents faring? What's the environmental impact and the state's response? And what's next for the industry? Joining us are Maryam Jamil. She reports on labor and the environment for the Center for Public Integrity. Welcome, Maryam.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And David Brown is a toxicologist and founder of the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. Hello, David.
Hello, Mary. Thank you very much for inviting me to talk.
And we'll also talk with David Spiegelmeyer of the Marcellus Shale Coalition a little bit later on this hour. And worth noting, we did reach out to the State Department of Environmental Protection, which declined our invitation to appear on this show. So let's start with you, Maryam, and give us, if you would, a brief overview of the fracking process.
Oh, so in the fracking process, you basically are trying to extract natural gas that is many, many feet underground. And so you're tapping into a large shale formation, a large rock, basically, that trillions of years ago began to form. And now you have natural gas trapped in these little cracks in this rock. So you are now plunging, you're plunging water, you're plunging sand, you're plunging a mixture of chemicals that allow this to go smoothly deep into the earth. So that these little cracks will now release natural gas that will come back up to the surface that we are now able to use for our many needs for natural gas.
And David Brown, what sorts of chemicals are used?
Well, there's a variety of chemicals. There's actually sand that goes down there. There's actually some chemicals that are acids and some chemicals, hydrochloric acid is one, and others go down. Lots of water. The chemicals are diluted in high volumes of water. There's also chemicals that are in there that we don't know what they are. Some are to make the water move better. They're called slick agents, causing the chemicals to be, the water to be slicker that they use. But there's a variety of chemicals that are put in, including biocides, pesticide-like chemicals, to prevent bacteria from forming sulfur compounds in the gas line.
Mm. And just kind of as we continue this brief refresher, Maryam, you know, residents in rural Pennsylvania who have well water, many of them have complained that some of this stuff is showing up in their wells, correct?
Yeah, and it's really hard for people to say often what exactly is showing up in their wells. What they know is that they have lived in their home maybe 30, 40 years, 10 years, and they've always drank their water and felt pretty comfortable with it, but now they see something different. Maybe it'll be that their bathtubs and toilets are starting to get some staining that they didn't recognize before, or something more obtrusive and alarming like water that's coming out kind of gray or sediment coming through their faucets and things like that. So they often can't say quite what it is, but they know even sometimes it's clear, but they're feeling kind of sick and they didn't feel that way before. And so they're kind of drawing a correlation sometimes between like what has changed in our area and what has changed in our water.
And to this date, when they complain to the State Department of Environmental Protection, what has been the response, Maryam?
So, I mean, you have some people who, if you look at the data, you have some people whose cases open and close fairly quickly, and it's a neat process. But for a lot of people, it'll drag on several months. It's very tricky, I think, for scientists at the DEP, for private water testers to really get an understanding of what has impacted a water supply, because there are so many possible causes. So for the DEP, they have the same challenge on their hands. And the main goal isn't necessarily to say your water is safe to drink or here's an alternative, this is what you should do. It's to say whether or not the water has been impacted by oil and gas. And that can be a really tricky question to answer. So you have some people, you have like about 288 cases maybe now, or no, 278 cases presently that the DEP said these were impacted by oil and gas. And for those people, then the industry, the company that's operating nearby, is then responsible for replacing their water supply. And then for the rest of the people, you have a lot of people who are so sure that their water was impacted because they know nothing else changed, but they don't necessarily have the proof. So depending on what they can afford, they might just get some water filters. They might just buy water, bottled water for years, or they might move away, or, you know, they might decide it's okay, we'll just kind of keep drinking this. And for some people, it's not necessarily those thousands of complaints. We don't know the true story behind each one of them. It might just be that they had, you know, seasonal water loss, and they also noticed that there's drilling nearby, so they decided to make that correlation, but it's not the actual cause. So there's lots of things that could be behind these different complaints, but what you end up with is thousands of people who aren't really sure whether or not they should be drinking their water and don't necessarily have a solution for a replacement water supply.
And again, Maryam, I just want to get back to the state's role in all of this and its response. My understanding is the process within the state itself is fractured.
Yeah, so if you look at the different, just the way complaints are responded throughout the state, you'll have make a complaint and have a completely different experience than somebody in the northeast of the country, of the state, than you will in the southwest of the state. You'll have people who inspectors come back to them for months and months, and they really have no idea of when their case might end or when they'll be hearing from the DEP next. Or it's just there's been – for the people I've talked to, I tried to talk to as many people as I could who are having some of these issues. There's a lot of confusion and a lot of frustration on behalf of the residents in just trying to get a straight answer from the DEP.
All right. And David Brown, as we mentioned, you're founder of the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. What is your take on health concerns related to fracking?
I think that there are health effects. I think there are exposures. That seems to be clear. People are seeing chemicals in their water. They're seeing chemicals in their air. So the exposures are clearly occurring. In fact, some evidence of that has been shown in some of the water tests that have been that have come back that have identified chemicals that are there. So we know that there are people that are exposed. Part of the problem is that some of those people, many of them actually, are experiencing health effects or are experiencing changes in their health. And the responses that we're getting are focused on more of an environmental regulatory process rather than on a public health process.
How do you mean?
When people have health effects, health departments traditionally go and talk to the sick people and evaluate what they look like, what their effects are like, in as large a group as they can in a particular neighborhood to try to define what the problem could be. That's usually the first step. When a large number of people in a state or elsewhere in a condition begin to express health effects, you ask a few simple questions like, are they different? Are they the same? Are they correlated with, associated with certain kinds of activities around them? Are they serious? And if the answer to that is that there's a large number of people, and there is a considerably large number of people, the Environmental Health Project actually goes and talks to people, we're getting similar kinds of complaints, so similar kinds of health effects, our nurse practitioner, our physicians here, from different people in different parts of the state and different parts. We work primarily in Washington County. So we're hearing the similar kinds of health effects from similar people.
It sounds like a process that can take quite a while.
It actually can be done quite rapidly.
And rapid meaning how quickly?
Oh, if a health department wanted to do it, and went out on an interview process, in 3 to 6 months, they should have defined the potential for a problem looking at the health of people.
Because in the meantime, go ahead.
The system is developed from looking at disease outbreaks for things like tuberculosis or measles or whatever, and so you have to operate quickly to get things under control. So the system is very rapid. It doesn't seek a lot of academic evaluation. It simply asks a bunch of questions and puts them together as rapidly as they can and come up with a general overview of what does the problem look like.
So while this is going on, though, you have somebody perhaps who's gone to their physician and they're talking about their symptoms. How does the physician know how to treat them, you know, while the process of identification is going on?
All the physician can do initially is treat the symptoms that he's seeing. If they have it associated with something, one of the rules that is to stop the exposure, recommend that the person be warned or told, don't, for example, drink your water, vent your house because the water can contaminate your house. Try to identify, keep a diary and identify when effects are coming on, what behaviors are associated with them, and stop doing that. So it's possible in that interim phase to give people some guidance.
Because I know
it's really important, because what happens is that people lose confidence in themselves, they lose confidence in the medical community, and they lose confidence in the regulatory community. And once they've lost confidence in them, it's very difficult to solve the problem because the trust piece has been lost.
Maryam Jamil, I know earlier in the process, I guess over a number of years, there have been questions about whether doctors in the area have been adequately trained to recognize symptoms as possibly related to contaminated water. Is this changing and changing for the better?
You know, in my conversation with the Department of Health and in talking with different residents, it sounds like the Department of Health recognizes that this was a problem in the past, because if you talk to residents, you'll find that they tried to complain to the Department of Health, but they didn't necessarily get answers early on, which leads, I think, to more of that lack of trust in regulatory agencies and also in themselves and in basically feeling legitimate in their claim that, hey, I'm having this experience and I think it's a problem. But it does sound like the Department of Health is now interested in collecting this information systematically, and they're doing it actively when they get complaints. I think now they have a proper system for tracking them. And I talked to residents who literally said they made a phone call to the Department of Health in 2012, 2013, and just in these past couple months, they've gotten people from the Department of Health, epidemiologists, coming to them and saying, hey, let's talk for a couple hours and tell me what you've been experiencing. So it does sound like they are trying to do what they can today.
All right. We've got an update on fracking and the Marcellus Shale. This hour of Radio Times, Maryam Jamil reports on labor and the environment for the Center for Public Integrity. David Brown is a toxicologist and founder of the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. Later this hour, we'll talk to David Spiegelmeyer of the Marcellus Shale Coalition. But if you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number, 888-477-9499. This is WHYY in Philadelphia, Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowane, and we're bringing you the latest on natural gas drilling in the Marcellus Shale, environmental concerns regarding fracking, the state's role in all of this, and much more. Our guests this hour include David Brown, a toxicologist and founder of the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project, and Maryam Jamil is a reporter who covers labor and the environment for the Center for Public Integrity. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So we're talking about the environmental effects. Maryam, once again, back to you. On the flip side, fracking has brought jobs to many depressed areas in the state. How has the industry overall affected or changed local economies?
You know, there's a lot of positive numbers out there basically showing that you have people who did not have easy access to jobs before. And when industry came in and was able to provide these many different, there are lots of, in addition to the actual fracking, there are lots of things involved in the process that create jobs. And so you have areas where you have local farmers who didn't necessarily have great revenue coming in, but now because they lease some of their land, they now have a steady stream of a couple $1,000s coming in each month that can really make a difference. Or you have people who were in need of a job, and now, you know, between 2007 and 2012, 15,000-ish jobs were created in the state, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and that can make a big difference for people. So I definitely talked to residents who, even though they had wells quite near them and different fracking infrastructure within a very small vicinity, we're quite content because they're like, you know what, this is what happens when industry comes to an area, as it has in different parts of the country and in this very state before, and we're benefiting from it in some ways. So,
David Brown, do these benefits, in your opinion, in some ways outweigh the environmental risks for local residents?
I think the answer is probably not for those people who are being exposed, whose houses live near, who live near these facilities, and near the pipelines that are transporting the gas. They actually get sick enough. We have people identified that have actually abandoned their houses and left them, and it certainly didn't make their lives any better. There may be people in the community or communities who have gained money from the gas drilling that have made them a little more prosperous. The question is, though, is that the only way we can get those benefits by putting people potentially at risk? And I don't think that's the case. The people who are sick are really sick, and they really are exposed, and we don't know what their future is going to look like. A study out of the University of Pittsburgh showed increased low birth weight babies. There's been a couple of studies that have described effects on reproduction in people who live within a mile or a quarter of a mile of these facilities. So I don't think that a community looking at it in those terms would be willing to accept that kind of a trade-off. And they shouldn't have to, because it should be possible to identify what is happening that's exposing people and get that under control. It might mean that we won't be able to put a gas well right next to a grammar school. It might mean that we'll have to provide some sort of control of the emissions that are coming from the facilities. But I think, is going to be a relatively small expense compared to the potential health risks that we're experiencing. We don't know how long the health risks are going to be, but we do know in the past, when things like this have happened, the health risks have been enormous and have stretched down for a century. For example, putting lead in gasoline was clearly a bad idea.
So, David Brown, then it sounds as if change needs to happen, and I'm guessing legislatively, and if I am correct, then is that going to happen with the current legislature?
I think if the current legislature, if we could drop the drama and the current legislature could sit down and objectively look at what the information is that's being collected, and some very good information has been collected in the last 2 to 3 years about this, and we could sit down with industry, because industry doesn't want to hurt anybody, that the legislature could arrive at systems that would, in fact, protect the health and protect the ability of the industry to go forward. But an acrimonious debate, I don't believe, will get us any. Will solve this problem.
And Maryam Jamil, the debate on some issues regarding fracking has been acrimonious. And for instance, the gas severance tax. Do you see in the near future an agreement reached, a compromise reached with all sides to regulate fracking further in the state?
You know, I'm not quite sure because they had worked on the Chapter 78 and Chapter 78A updates for quite some time. And just recently they passed SB 279, which basically cut the conventional side of those regulations that they've been working on for quite some time to further regulate and put some controls on the potential environmental impacts caused by oil and gas production. So I couldn't quite say. I haven't been following Pennsylvania for many years. This was a project where I sort of dropped into Pennsylvania, but I was surprised to see that, and it seemed like many people in the communities that were advocating for tighter regulations were also surprised to see such a change after years of compromise and years of working together to develop those regulations.
Hmm. Well, natural gas prices have been down. We mentioned that at the top of the show. And the industry has been downsizing. Tell us, illustrate the effects, if you would, in some of the towns across rural Pennsylvania. Mary Ann, what's been happening there?
Yeah, well, you hear of people with abandoned wells near their homes, or people who they were once employed by the industry, but now they're not quite as. I think for me, actually, that led to people being more eager to talk because they were no longer employed by the industry, or no longer necessarily seeing themselves as employed next year by the industry. You have people who there are less jobs out there. People are maybe feeling less of that warmth that they felt in 2011, 2012, where they were more likely to be gaining their income thanks to natural gas and thanks to the Marcellus Shale.
If they're willing to talk, what are you hearing from them? What sentiments?
I mean, I was specifically doing a story on environmental impact. So I was hearing from the people that David Brown is referring to who are dealing with impacts to their health and dealing with water quality that's been tainted that they've never had confirmed by anybody whether or not it was directly tied to natural gas. They didn't find those natural gas chemicals in it necessarily, but you had people who are basically more willing to voice their complaints and their concerns that, yeah, they've had trouble breathing for the past few years, or they're worried about the bumps on their skin that they didn't see a few years ago, things like that. You might be less willing to say if the person who provides your paycheck or the company that provides your paycheck each month is the same one that maybe you think might be also a factor in your health.
Sure. And we're going to get to the calls here in just a second. But another quick question for you, David Brown. So if there's been a downturn in the industry, are you hearing of a corresponding downturn in negative environmental effects?
Well, we look at health and environmental effects, and we've actually seen effects being reported to us from the processing of the gas and the transport of gas also. It's important to realize that the gas that comes back is different from the natural gas that came back years ago, that the fracked gas actually is methane plus other compounds, some of which are separated and not, and some of which would be detected in the water samples that are being done and not. As we're a science public health organization. I was a founder with about five other people, by the way. But what we are finding and are concerned about is that the water studies that have been done are not complete enough, and they were not collected properly enough to consider what the chemicals are that might be causing these effects. We do see fewer people. Well, I would be guessing. I think we see fewer people who are moderately ill. We're seeing, but people who are near processing plants, a cryogenic plant, and things like that, they're showing health effects because the gas, the contaminants in the gas are being released into the air and into the water. Once the water table is contaminated, though, it doesn't make too much difference what the company does next.
Hmm. And again, many of these people are stuck. They don't have the means to go anywhere else.
It's worse than that. They don't know what their situation is. The information that is available in terms of what is being released from the wells is incomplete. It's very slow to turn up. They have children who are sick or seeming to be sick. some of the effects are fairly general. Extreme fatigue, for example, which is almost indescribable for them. But it's usually headaches, some nosebleeds, a lot of sleep disturbances coming by, a lot of respiratory effects. And those effects are effects that were seen in the Yale study by Rabinowitz, where he saw skin effects and respiratory effects. He looked at 190 people in Washington County, and the reproductive effects were seen by Bruce Pitt at University of Pittsburgh, and cardiovascular effects have been identified by the people from Johns Hopkins. So that kind of information just makes, if you're exposed, it's hard to put into perspective with the headache that you may be experiencing time to time.
And Maryam Jamil, these people who are in limbo, again, there's little recourse for them?
Yeah, there's very little recourse. So a lot of the fracking is being done in rural areas, and a lot of people in rural areas use private wells as their source of water. And so that's not regulated by the EPA nor by the state, because, you know, in Pennsylvania, you can literally just you can drill a hole in the ground until you hit water, and then you will be able to drink water from there. And so it's quite difficult to regulate. But then when people have the situation where they're like, hey, I need a fix, I need a replacement, it gets very complicated. But you have, you know, there's resources. Penn State Extension offers a lot of advice to people with potential water concerns, and many people who are living in areas where there is no oil and gas activity also have some different issues with contamination or just, you know, levels that are too high of iron or the other. But there's no city that you're relying on that is then responsible, like in Flint, Michigan, where it fell upon somebody's shoulders to be responsible for a clean water supply. And if you you can drill a new well, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're tapping into a water supply that is clean or that won't be contaminated in the coming years by the same thing that contaminated your water supply. There are many kind of different turns it can take, but most of them are very costly, and many of them don't really guarantee you clean water. So you are quite stuck. And then one thing that was interesting that I was surprised by is there is, you know, Pennsylvania law says that if you are found to have been impacted by the industry, then that company is responsible to replace your water supply or restore it. But that's a lot easier said than done. There isn't really a solution. There isn't really like one thing you can point to as the process for getting you a fixed water supply, even now that somebody with resources is capable of paying for it and responsible for paying for it for you.
Yeah, bottled water in a truck is considered to be a replacement, correct?
Yeah, and then that I talked to people who, you know, that was their solution, and they said they didn't really have much of a say in it, and there wasn't much of an alternative, so they went with it. But then they have no idea if that's going to be 5 years of bottled water, 10 years of bottled water, the rest of their lives. And then there are many other things that come with having your water supply damaged that the law doesn't account for. Like maybe, yeah, you can have your safe drinking water because you get bottles and you have some filters on your showers and things like that. But that doesn't do anything for your property value that has very likely gone down now that you can't tell the future purchasers of your house that there's a clean, steady supply of water or health, et cetera.
I'd like to just get to a quick call before the break. Joseph in Ocheson, Delaware, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. I was part of that boom up there in Sullivan County, Bradford County, Wysox area. My experience has been that one of our guys in our group, I drove a tractor trailer hauling fresh water from the Susquehanna to hundreds of well sites. And he was in a case with Chesapeake. I can only speak for Chesapeake Gas Company now. Is when he had told them that this 4-acre plot that he has his trailer on, you know, that the water was contaminated, they right away came out with buffalo tanks, I think, that are like 1,000 gallons each of fresh water. Now, having said that, the whole area up there was depressed. It was, you know, it was really good shape back in the 50s and 60s. My boss owned a saw log mill, and it's been he's been shut down as one guy working. But his old trucks, he bought two tanks, $50,000 each, and he ran them trucks 24 hours a day. They were paying $100 an hour. And as far as the property values go, just to rent a house up there, a four-bedroom house, was $2,000. And to buy houses, they had skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that it did bring a lot of prosperity to that area that was down for 30 or 40 years. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are rich now that have them old farms in the family for 100 years and were piecemealing them off. And now they have, you know, maybe one, two wells that were at the time in 2010 mm-hmm. to 12, bringing $50,000 a month.
Yeah.
And I'll take my response off the air. Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph. And thank you for the snapshot. I mean, he is illustrating really what the boom brought to that part of the state. David Brown, what's your response?
Well, the boom certainly did help people and in many situations, particularly farmers who needed the money and can use the money, and the communities did do well in many respects. What needed to be put together with the boom was a serious look at the other ancillary effects that could be occurring in communities, the amount of the health of various people in the communities, the crime, those people who were saying that they might be they were having difficulties with it. And what we didn't have do with that is to create an infrastructure to look at the health issues and correct the problems when they occurred. So while the boom was going forward, the investment didn't acknowledge the health issues that are potentially there. And those health issues, for the number of people that have them, the number is not really small.
Yeah.
In Washington County, there's about 200,000 people.
David, I'm going to have to stop you there because we're up against a break. We'll pick up in a moment. David Brown with the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. Maryam Jamil is with the Center for Public Integrity. And in a couple moments, we'll also be talking to David Spiegelmeyer of the Marcellus Shale Coalition. There's more of Radio Times just ahead. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. In this hour, we're bringing you the latest on natural gas drilling in the Marcellus Shale. David Brown is a toxicologist and co-founder of the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. Maryam Jamil, a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity. And in a few moments, we'll be joined by David Spiegelmeyer, president of the Marcellus Shale Coalition. Maryam, a quick question to you before we wrap up this part of the program. You know, Patrick McDonnell is acting secretary of the DEP. How critical is it that a secretary without the acting part of the name be at the helm for environmental protection to move forward?
It does seem quite crucial to have somebody who is at the head being able to fully put all their energy into regulating the oil and gas industry, into regulating the many other things that the Department of Environmental Protection is responsible for. Because even with former Secretary Quigley at the head, and pushing quite hard for regulations to actually come through and not be in limbo for such a long time, you have happening what you have happening with, you know, there are a lot of things that are going on that are in great need of proper regulation, that are in great need of just more feet on the ground. And so it does seem as though somebody who is fully in place quickly would be to both the industry's interest and to citizens and environmentalists.
And some last thoughts from you here, David Brown. As we move forward in this process, what does the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project, what is the next step, in your opinion, that has to be taken in order to rectify some of the health concerns?
Well, I think we have to identify people who have been exposed and follow them to see what the long-term health effects will be, because they've been exposed to compounds that produce long-term health effects. I think we need to have a very strong public health agency that operates immediately and focuses on the need to understand the health issues that are present. That has not happened to this date. I think we're the only group in the country that's actually going and interviewing sick people to try to find out what their sickness is. That's something that has to be done not just in Pennsylvania, but by the CDC and others. And it's vital to not make a grave mistake.
All right. I sense frustration, not sure about hope, but definitely frustration on your part, David Brown.
Hopeful because so many brilliant people have come forward. The people who are being injured are amazingly factual about what's happening. They're saying, get our data to help others. So I'm comfortable with that. I'm comfortable that ATSDR has begun to develop some important reports. I'm comfortable that papers are discussions like this are taking place. We don't need acrimony and drama. What we need is a sober, hard look at what the problem is and at the potential solutions for it.
Thank you so much, David Brown. We appreciate you joining us for this hour, this portion of Radio Times.
You're welcome.
David is a toxicologist and a co-founder of the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. And our thanks to you as well, Maryam Jamil.
Thank you very much.
Maryam covers labor and the environment for the Center for Public Integrity. And joining us now is David Spiegelmeyer, president of the Marcellus Shale Coalition, the region's largest shale development trade association. Welcome to Radio Times, David.
Yes, good morning, Mary. How are you?
Well, thank you. So, as you've been listening to the program, there continues to be concern about well contamination as a possible result of fracking. So what is the coalition's position on this?
You know, we've taken a pragmatic approach to addressing and educating the public on the issues of natural gas development. You know, there's a perception that our industry doesn't want to be regulated, that we don't care about people. Nothing could be, further from the truth. We're a heavily regulated industry. Safety is our top priority. Since 2008, when this industry really kicked off, we've worked hard to modernize Pennsylvania's regulatory oversight framework for natural gas development. I did join a few moments ago and listen to the comment, well, we need inspectors and agency folks to provide oversight of this industry. I want to share with you that prior to 2008, there were 60 compliance and inspection staff in DEP's oil and natural gas section. Mm-hmm. Today, as a result of the dollars being put into the agency from the industry, from increases in permitting fees and carve-out from the impact fee that's collected across Pennsylvania, DEP's gone from 60 compliance and inspection staff to over 202.
Okay.
With today, a little over 15 rigs active in Pennsylvania. We have a vibrant regulatory agency to provide oversight over our industry, funded by the industry.
Okay.
Contributions from impact fee and from permit fees that have gone from $100 a well to $5,000 a well.
So, David Spiegelmeyer, let's get to the latest science. Has there been any connection that has been found, in your opinion, between fracking and some well contamination?
You know, EPA has completed study. They've not found widespread systemic impacts to drinking water supplies. There have been cases where methane that exists in the upper crust has found its way into water wells. But you'll find what the industry's done to modernize the regulatory framework has been 2,500 feet from any well location, any natural gas well location. We do pre-drill testing. And we have found one in four water wells across Pennsylvania prior to any natural gas development have problems meeting public drinking water criteria. And as a result, that information is provided back to the landowner. And I think what you're finding is that the DEP and the EPA have gone out and done rigorous review of water wells across Pennsylvania in areas where folks make claims that their water's been impacted. In most cases, they've had pre-existing conditions that make their water less than acceptable from a public drinking water standard standpoint. Doesn't mean that it's not important. It certainly is important. Pennsylvania is one of only two states across the nation that don't have public drinking water well development standards, and we have certainly advocated for Having water well construction standards set in Pennsylvania, we've not gone that far yet, but it's an important step and one that we think we need to take in the Commonwealth.
So you think that that then will further safety and relieve fears of contamination if individual well regulations regarding individual well construction are tightened up, or at least implemented?
I tell you, the EPA study, they found areas where there could be potential impact on drinking water, and I would tell you the primary location is on the surface, if you have a surface spill. What they found is that mechanisms are in place that have protected public drinking water, that, you know, there are folks out there that have worked hard, and I would say that they've, you know, try to promote a political agenda to try and eliminate the development of our fossil fuels. And today, more than 80% of our energy today in our economy is produced through fossil fuels. We all have skin in the game. You know, our life-sustaining power supplies are in jeopardy if we take an activist agenda and eliminate hydraulic fracturing. Again, 1 in 3 electrons that we use in our homes today, that power that we have 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, are produced primarily by fossil fuels. Less than 5% across our nation are produced through, mm-hmm. you know, wind and solar applications.
Fair enough.
We shouldn't do wind. We should do wind and solar. We're a great partner for wind and solar, but we all have skin in the game.
So tell us,
nearly
David,
every consumer product. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. And the point well taken. We all rely on energy sources, and at this point, solar and wind are you know just a small fraction of the providers. Tell us how the gas drilling industry is faring. There were boom years up until, I guess, about last year. So tell us a little bit about the downturn and whether you think that's going to change.
Yeah, it's there's a good side and a bad side. The good side is that consumers across Pennsylvania, across our nation, are the direct beneficiary. Here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, purchased natural gas costs from the utilities across the Commonwealth have dropped anywhere from 53% to 74% as a result of new heightened supplies of natural gas that have been generated here in Pennsylvania from Marcellus Shale development. That's saving consumers millions and millions of dollars that can be used for other things in our economy. From a direct impact on our industry, you know, natural gas prices back in 2008 at the wellhead were at $13.71. Today they're at $1.35. So you can see the decline and why we've seen such a decline in activity. When I heard a comment made about activity in northern Pennsylvania, there have been generational change brought about in that region through the investments made by our industry. There is no doubt that communities in northern Pennsylvania have benefited. Communities across the southeastern part of Pennsylvania have benefited. You look at the investments being made in the petrochemical centers in the Philadelphia region. That region is benefiting by jobs and economic opportunity. And the fact that we're producing more natural gas, using more natural gas in power generation, we're at a 27-year low in carbon dioxide emissions. No one brings that up. I want to say that the industry is polluting, but I would tell you, we're cleaning our atmosphere because we're using more natural gas in power generation in Pennsylvania.
So almost, there's such a glut of natural gas now, it's almost too much of a good thing in that there are many fewer drilling operations in Pennsylvania. Well, David Spiegelmeyer, you know, there have been boom times thanks to the industry in some of these small towns. But what do you, how do you rectify the fact that now that we're in a down cycle, some of these towns are struggling, jobs are leaving, and some of these little businesses that have built up around the industry are suffering?
There are no doubt some areas where there has been economic pressure. But I would tell you that our major areas across the state are seeing a boom in manufacturing. Why? Because we now have the most affordable energy across the globe here in Pennsylvania. The Allegheny Conference and the Pittsburgh Chamber reported their greatest growth last year in the Pittsburgh region was in the area of manufacturing. You see the revitalization of the Marcus Hook Industrial Complex, the petrochemical complex, the investments being made by Sunoco Logistics in Philadelphia. Today, having a vibrant port process as a result of newfound supplies of natural gas and natural gas liquids that are revitalizing the southeastern port,
sure,
you know, in Philadelphia.
And again,
economic
Again, the point is well taken, David Spiegelmeyer, but it's a cyclical industry. So, you know, when times are tough, when you've got a downturn, then how does the industry help these communities get through the downturn?
You know, that, yeah, again, I think our primary focus right now is to try and find new manufacturing and new opportunities for job growth that come from affordable supplies of natural gas. I mean, the reality is exactly what you said. When gas prices dropped that precipitously over the last 3 years, we've seen a significant decline in rig count. I will tell you that the development of the infrastructure, pipeline development, has been fairly vibrant across Pennsylvania. That continues to provide an economic benefit for the regions where pipelines are being developed and investment made in those areas as well. You know, one thing I was trying to get to a moment ago is that we all have skin in the game, and it's not just those power supplies I talked about, but it's life-sustaining pharmaceutical medications are manufactured through natural gas, the use of natural gas. Nearly every consumer product, steel, glass, plastics, chemicals, the fertilizers used to produce our food. You know, I talked about power generation.
Sure.
Those products we use every day are manufactured through the use of natural gas, and the political sound bites coming from some with an agenda to slow or stop natural gas development has the potential to impact our way of life as a society, to have power 24 hours a day, to be able to drive our cars.
David, I wish we had more time. I wish we had more time. There are pluses and minuses to almost any situation we can talk about. I'd like to get in one call. Max in Philadelphia, you're live on Radio Times, and our guest is David Spiegelmeyer.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
I live in Philly now. I'm from Bradford County, Sarah Bradford County, and I was a reporter up there. And you know, there's so many different things I could talk about. Specifically, I mentioned to the administrator there, the people from out of state, but the topic has since changed. There are huge industrial complexes up there that Chesapeake built specifically that are completely vacant, and they've kind of just, with the downturn, in my opinion, my anecdotal experience as a resident of that area and someone covering that area, they have really done nothing to alleviate some of the stressors that have come up from the downturn.
Okay.
I have friends that
Max, you know what? We're really running short on time, and I need to give David Spiegelmeyer a chance to respond. So, but we appreciate the call to Radio Times. David, what's your response?
I'm aware of the Bradford County situation well because I've worked that area significantly. And the reporter's correct that there was a new operating headquarters developed in that region. To say it's completely vacant is not accurate. There are still service personnel from Chesapeake that work in that facility. And the fact that they have acreage in that region, as gas prices continue to recover over time, and when you have less activity and less gas coming to the wellhead over time, there'll be additional capital spent in that region and jobs generated longer term. It's why they haven't sold those facilities, why they haven't moved out of the region, why there are still staff there that maintain and operate their wells. Longer term, I think the future is very, very bright for that region to see investment return to that area in natural gas development. It's that the price of natural gas is dropped to the point where folks are not willing to invest the capital necessary today to keep that alive.
So you see jobs returning to these depressed areas then?
Absolutely.
Natural gas drilling jobs related to the industry because of, as the cycle continues, another upturn?
Yes, I would tell you we're already seeing jobs in the pipeline industry to build the infrastructure necessary to gather that gas and get that gas to consumers. But the upstream activity of the drilling for natural gas, we're very much still at the end of the first inning of a long game here to be able to produce our natural gas resources in the Commonwealth, to produce it in an environmentally responsible fashion and provide the benefits to our consumers across the Commonwealth.
All right, David Spiegelmeyer, thank you so much for joining us for this portion of Radio Times. David is a president of the Marcellus Shale Coalition. And as always, we invite you to visit our Facebook page here at Radio Times. Just head to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you'll find our podcasts at that address as well. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thank you for joining us.